You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, the story of three 19th century women who befriended one another and were instrumental in both the abolition and early women's rights movements. One is well known to history, Harriet Tubman, one of the conductors of the Underground Railroad, who moved over 70 people from slavery to freedom. Once the Fugitive Slave Act was passed, though, escaped slaves were at risk even in northern states, and the town of Auburn, New York, became an important way station on the way to Canada. And there, Tubman turned to her two friends, Martha Coffin Wright, an early pioneer in the women's rights movement, as well as the abolition movement, who helped organize the Seneca Falls Convention, and Frances Seward, the wife of New York Governor and Senator William H. Seward, who served as Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of State in Lincoln's team of rivals. Frances Seward has been discounted by history, but New Yorker executive editor Dorothy Wickenden sheds new light on Frances's influence on Seward's progressive politics, as well as her important behind-the-scenes role in both the abolition and women's rights movements, as well as the story behind all three women who sheltered and helped escaped slaves make a new way in the North, and also laid the groundwork for an expansion of women's rights later in the 19th and 20th century. Wickenden's new history is titled The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights. The book also brings to light the national politics and intense debate over slavery and women's rights movement that shaped the 1840s, 50s, and Civil War period. Wickenden is the executive editor of The New Yorker and hosts the magazine's weekly podcast, Politics and More. She previously worked as a reporter and editor at The New Republic and is the author of Nothing Daunted. Again, her new book is titled The Agitators, and she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Dorothy Wickenden, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How did you first learn about these three women? Now, of course, Harriet Tubman is a very well-known character in American history, but the other two that you write about in The Agitators, Martha Coffin Wright, maybe less known, and Frances Seward, even less known.
Well, I have to thank my grandmother, actually, because she grew up in Auburn in the late 1800s into the early 20th century. And I was actually working on my previous book, Nothing Daunted, about her experience with her best friend from Auburn teaching school way out in the wilds of western Colorado. So I was working on that, and I was checking on something she had told me, which was that her grandparents had lived next door to the Sewards. So I went to the Seward House Museum, and I quickly learned that her story was true, that they had, that family had lived next door to the Sewards. And the tour guide that I got, who was a young education director at the time, really didn't want to talk much about the famous William H. Seward, you know, Secretary of State to Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. She wanted to talk about Frances Seward, whom she thought had been really overlooked and misjudged by earlier historians, especially the earliest ones. The earliest modern biographer of Seward dismissed Frances Seward as a neurotic invalid. And I was told, well, actually, she was more radical than her husband. She was an abolitionist. And I just thought that was really interesting. And I interesting enough that when I finished that book, I started reading the biographies of Seward and just got little tiny glimpses of Frances Seward. I wondered about her letters, whether they had survived, found out that they did, went to go read them, some of them, in the at the University of Rochester, where the collection is kept. And I was just bowled over by the personality of this woman who was so vivid, she kind of leapt off the page. And I just thought, this alone is an incredible story. And I knew that she had lived around the corner from Martha Coffin Wright, who was a Quaker, who very anti-slavery. They had become good friends and kind of banded together in this very conservative town over their interest in women's rights and abolition. And then I heard that Harriet Tubman ended up spending half of her life after the war, you know, almost 50 years in Auburn. And I just thought, well, that's incredible. And I wondered how Harriet Tubman decided to spend most of her life in Auburn, understood that it was through her friendship and collaboration on the Underground Railroad with these other two women. And it soon became clear that this was a story that had never been told, and I thought it should be.
In fact, Frances Seward sold her the land for her house there, would have given it to her, except that Harriet Tubman wouldn't accept it.
Yes, and that's absolutely right. And also of interest there is that other historians just have routinely said that William H. Seward sold her the property. And that's just, I realized that as I was doing this work that that couldn't be right. I mean, Frances Seward was Harriet Tubman's good friend. Seward was down in Washington the whole time. Frances Seward lived in Auburn. She refused to go to Washington to live with her husband because she hated that slave town. And so, and then furthermore, he was off on a tour of Europe and Palestine when the sale took place. So clearly this was a decision that, that Frances Seward had made. And so it was just one of those little kind of windows into history where people have just kind of assumed a certain thing forever, and it just wasn't right.
And actually, you detail why it was Frances Seward, because these women earlier had worked on passage of a bill in New York that gave women property rights. One of the first, I would think.
Well, what New York State was one of the early states to pass this law, which was incredibly important, because until that point, in New York, as throughout most of the country, women were literally regarded as the property of their husbands once they got married. So someone like Frances Seward, who is inherited a great deal of wealth from her father, she technically lost all of that to her husband. And furthermore, husbands were legally allowed to beat up their wives with impunity, which they did all the time. So the earliest women's rights crusaders pushed for, I think, a decade to get that law through the state legislature, and they finally succeeded. So it sort of showed the women of New York that if they worked hard enough, they could change the law, even though they had no, you know, until that point, they had absolutely no power at all.
Right. And really, this becomes one of the underpinnings for the suffrage movement, you know, 50, 60 years later, is the fact that if a woman can own property, which the Constitution talks about property owners having rights, then why can't they have the right to vote?
Absolutely, because they had to pay taxes. You know, if they own property, they had to pay taxes. If you pay taxes, you're a citizen, and you should be able to vote like everyone else who paid taxes, i.e. white men, mostly.
You know, I was fascinated by your descriptions that you read about Frances Seward, and I'm sure that was what sort of spurred this investigation, these two extremes, that she was, one, a neurotic invalid, or two, a radical abolitionist. Which did you find closer to the truth, and how do you reconcile those two views? Was it just that, you know, man's perspective, 19th century man's perspective coming out in that first description?
Well, this is one of the things that I loved about writing the book, because, and it almost felt sometimes as though I was writing fiction because I had to recreate these characters and all of their complexities. And a critic just reviewing the book just described Frances Seward very aptly, I thought, as a woman at war with herself. And she was. She had been brought up to be a womanly person. And, you know, women, you know, especially of her class, didn't make trouble. They were quiet and recessive. And that's what she was by temperament. However, she also had this incredibly powerful conscience. And when she had her first view of slavery in 1833, when she and Seward took a trip to the South, she was completely appalled. She couldn't get over it. And that was when she really committed herself to abolition, and she committed herself to women's rights at about the same time, even a little bit earlier, when she saw that her sister, her beloved sister who lived around the corner, was being beaten up by her husband. Mm-hmm. And neither woman had any way to appeal that through the law, because that was the married women's property law had not yet passed.
You know, as I read her accounts with William H. Seward, which you refer to as Henry throughout the book, I assume that was his familiar name. He went by Henry.
Yes, his family and Francis, they all called him Henry.
In the letters, I got this sense of correspondence sort of reminded me of John Adams and Abigail Adams. You know, Abigail Adams famously stayed in Massachusetts and ran the household and ran the farm, did all the work of the farm. And Frances sort of did the same at their household in Auburn, New York. And yet her letters were always pushing him. You know, Seward was a politician, so he pushed as only as far as he thought he could as a politician. And Frances was always pushing him further.
Yes, and this, too, was just an interesting way to think about how social movements occur, because he quite rightly, Seward was a very forthright anti-slavery politician. He went way beyond what most politicians, did at the time, including Abraham Lincoln for many years. And he made, obviously, tremendous enemies by doing so. Nevertheless, you know, once he became a U.S. senator, once he went to Washington in 1850, and then he had served two terms, and then he became Lincoln's Secretary of State just as the war was beginning, he realized that as whatever his conscience told him to do, he could only move as quickly as the country, as his constituents would let him. And so he maintained very strong friendships by letter with abolitionists throughout the North, and they were, including Frederick Douglass, and they were constantly writing to him saying, you've got to move on this, you've got to move. And then he would write back and he said, no, that's your job. You have to go out and convince the people that it is time to abolish slavery. And once the public, a majority of the public agrees to that, then I can push legislation in the Senate.
Now, it's interesting you referred to Frances Seward as a woman at war with herself. And certainly that was also the case somewhat with Martha Coffin Wright as well. But in Frances' case, she's a politician's wife. She can't be in public. I mean, she's constantly at battle with her beliefs and what she works for privately with what she can do publicly.
Yes, it's a little different, though, because her personality is so different. Martha Coffin Wright, who was brought up as a Quaker and who had this very, very powerful older sister, Lucretia Mott, who was a Quaker minister and one of the very earliest advocates in the country for human rights, broadly conceived. So Martha came from a family where, you know, women, it was completely expected that women would speak out and, you know, say what they thought. And she was witty and sardonic and outspoken within her family and with Frances and with her within her close circle of friends. But she had never spoken in public before, and even though her older sister kept telling her she had to learn how to do this, she was very reluctant to do that at first. And actually, throughout her life, she didn't like it because she had been so indoctrinated in the idea that women didn't speak in public, period. So she and her older sister, Lucretia, were among the organizers of the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848, and Lucretia expected her to speak at this gathering of mostly of women, and she couldn't do it. Martha couldn't do it. And then, you know, over the she got to know Elizabeth Cady Stanton at Seneca Falls. Stanton enlisted her, realizing what an incredible force she was, and Stanton basically insisted that she join this incipient women's rights movement. And then, you know, over the years, insisted that she speak at their conventions. And so Martha learned how to do it, and she was very good at it, but she always doubted her abilities in that regard.
Yeah, there was I believe it was at the Seneca Falls Convention, Lucretia she tried to get Martha to speak, and she couldn't do it. And so finally she read a newspaper piece or a published piece that she had written, and, of course, it went over like gangbusters.
Did, and it was this totally sardonic, it was called Hints for Wives, and it was in response to an article that had been published in a Philadelphia newspaper where some man had said that women should always greet their husbands with a cheerful smile and be at their beck and call whenever, at every moment. And Martha just thought that was completely preposterous. So she sat down. She had never published a thing. She sat down and wrote this essay, mostly just to get it off her chest. And she sent it to Lucretia. And I think it must have been Lucretia, who lived in Philadelphia, who just decided, well, this has to be published. This is so funny and so right. And so Lucretia was annoyed with her younger sister for standing in the back of the room, you know, trying to disappear. She was 6 months pregnant, by the way, and Martha was, which was, she thought, a good enough excuse to not to put herself forward. And so Lucretia on the second afternoon, read this essay aloud, and the audience loved it. They laughed, and one person who loved it was one of the few men who was there, and that was Frederick Douglass, who had just started his newspaper, The North Star, in nearby Rochester. And he came up to Martha after this essay was read aloud, and he said, may I get your permission to reprint this in my newspaper? And Martha was flabbergasted. She, you know, he was the most famous abolitionist in the world. He had gone to Great Britain at that point, where he'd been for 2 years. He had come back. He himself was only had only escaped from slavery, I think, a decade earlier. But he was an enormously powerful figure even then, had taught himself essentially to read and write, and just, you know, as we know, had this incredible gift for words. And so she was just, of course, she granted permission. And more than that, she decided she would like to be his friend. And so he lectured across regularly across New York State. So whenever he came through Auburn, which was kind of midway in the state, she invited him to the house, sometimes for dinner, sometimes to spend the night. And that itself was an act of insurrection. You didn't socialize with black people. I mean, her neighbors were completely appalled. And they had already been gossiping about her because she didn't take her children to church on Sundays. And she just was obviously kind of a big outlier. And so when she so clearly was advocating and had no trouble telling them this, that she believed in absolute social equality between white people and black people. And they decided that she was truly a subversive character. And she was at the time. So they called her a very dangerous woman.
Yes, a very dangerous woman indeed. My guest today is Dorothy Wickenden, a journalist and author, executive editor of The New Yorker. She hosts the podcast Politics and More for the magazine. And her latest book is titled The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights. It's published by Scribner's. And that third friend, of course, is Harriet Tubman. And throughout the book, you go from each of these three women telling their story. Harriet Tubman, of course, well-known story, and all the stories of so many of her family members and extended family that she brought out from Maryland, her work in the war. So how did these three women from very different backgrounds become friends? Obviously, it was the abolition movement.
There's nothing written in the historical record, but earlier historians who've written about Lucretia Mott and concluded, and I completely agree, that it must have been Lucretia who introduced Martha to Harriet Tubman soon after Tubman arrived in Philadelphia. So in 1849, Harriet Tubman walked out of slavery in Poplar Neck, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore, walked almost 100 miles to Philadelphia because she had learned that this was a free city where black children could get an education, where black adults could get jobs, and where there were abolitionists who were plotting to overthrow slavery. So it sounded like her kind of place, and that's where she first settled. And she made it her business to get to know every abolitionist in the city, and Lucretia Mott was one of the most prominent abolitionists. So they got to know each other, and Martha frequently made family visits to Philadelphia. So it makes total sense that Lucretia introduced those two. And because Auburn, New York, as I said, right in the middle of New York State, made a perfect stop for Harriet Tubman on her Underground Railroad excursions. And this was how the Underground Railroad worked. It was this tightly knit organization, but spread all across the North and actually deep into the South as well. And it really depended on the most trusted contacts, everyone having the most trusted contacts at every step of the way. So this was an act of networking, and she put them together, and then Martha would have introduced Harriet Tubman to her close friend, Frances Seward, in Auburn, sometime in the early 1850s. Martha had been harboring fugitive slaves in her basement kitchen beginning in the early 1840s, and then Frances started early in the 1850s. So both of them had, and her former basement kitchen, she turned into a haven for fugitive slaves. So that's how that relationship began. And they quickly, not only were they associates, they just really, really liked and trusted each other. And they became lifelong friends, and they deeply influenced each other. They helped each other. Harriet Tubman was this remarkable, just phenomenal embodiment of what could be, what a woman of absolute, who had been beaten herself to within an inch of her life, just terrible, terrible handicaps, thanks to the slaveholders she had, answered to. What could be done? This woman had, freed herself, walked away from her husband, walked away from her family, although she went back and, brought them all up to the North. and, you know, then committed her life to this cause of freedom. And so they all, it was just at the, when they met, it was just at the time when Frances and Martha were transforming themselves from quite traditional homemakers into revolutionaries. And so imagine what Harriet Tubman meant to them. She just embodied the promise of freedom and justice.
Of course, your admiration for Francis Seward even grows because, you know, here at this point, Seward has been a governor in New York. He's now a senator. And with the Fugitive Slave Act, this is a felony. They're committing felonies in harboring escaped slaves in their home. And she is, both Martha and Francis are doing it, hosting Tubman when she comes through and hosting folks. And actually, she's providing plots of land for some of them as well to settle in Auburn, which is really interesting. I always thought of Auburn because of its connections to the abolition movement and the suffrage movement as being a very liberal place. But your book describes a very close-minded, very conservative place in which they were hissed down in public when they would have Martha Coffin Wright would have suffragette meetings and lecture series where they were presenting progressive views for that time, and, mm-hmm. and they were being shouted down. They were outliers in their community.
They really were, although it's worth saying that with the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850, New York State began to change a little bit. So it was mostly farmers, and in Auburn, which was an industrial city at the time, you know, there were bankers and businessmen and lawyers of all kinds. But they were basically conservative people. However, when the Fugitive Slave Act was passed and forced Northerners to report to federal authorities any suspected fugitive slave and then agree to have them, you know, transported back into slavery, there was a huge uproar against this across the North. And especially New York was really radicalized. So there were these conservative, you know, the state was largely conservative, but even some people who had formerly had no interest at all in slavery now decided that this was insupportable. They would not have the South dictating to them the way to run their states. And they had abolished slavery, you know, decades earlier.
In addition to telling the story of these three women and how their connections and their individual stories in your book, The Agitators, you also spend time on another subject, which gets into their core foundation beliefs. And it has to do with a case that both Francis Seward and Martha Wright's husbands worked on together, and that's the Freeman case. Why was this important to tell this story?
And that was pretty early on. So that was in 1846, and Seward was in Auburn. He was working as a lawyer at his own law firm at the time. And this case was a national sensation. A young black man who had recently been released from Auburn State Prison, where he had been incarcerated for 5 years for stealing a horse, and it was a crime it was later discovered he had not committed. He had been beaten on the head while he was there, and he had lost his hearing in one ear, and he clearly had kind of lost his mind. So anyway, he went on this murderous rampage. He invaded the farm of a wealthy family down the street from the Seward, killed four members of the family, immediately confessed to the crime. And, you know, anyone who listened to him or saw him could see that, you know, he was insane. And again, this goes to the early conservatism of the town. Everyone, except for the Wrights and the Sewards, believed that he should be hung. He should be hanged immediately without a
lynched.
Trial.
Lynched, in essence.
Lynched. Yeah. And there were mobs following this man as he was taken to the local jail. And so Seward was away at the time working on a legal case. Frances was completely appalled. She could hear the mob screaming outside their door saying, lynch him, don't let him live one more minute. And she wrote to Seward and talked about this as being, you know, intolerable. And she was the daughter of a lawyer and judge. And she said, you know, something about this just doesn't strike me as right. Why would he have done such a thing? There's no motive. What could it be? And so, but he came back immediately, and he decided to take this man's case. And he asked for David Wright, who was another local lawyer, to be his co-counsel, which the judge agreed to do. So these two families were the only people in town who stood up for the basic legal rights for this young black man. And Seward and David Wright were threatened with tar and feathering. Francis and Martha just thought that was nonsense, and they just told their husbands to do what was right, which they did. And they launched this legal defense of him. It was one of the first uses of the insanity defense in the country, knowing that the best they could get for him was life in the state asylum, and suspecting that they would lose the case regardless, but they felt they had to do it. And they did lose the case. So Francis's father, this county judge, and Seward's close political advisor, Thurlow Weed, said, don't do it. You'll ruin any political future you might hope to have. And it was just the opposite. He did such a magnificent job in the defense that he became nationally famous for exactly this. And of course, it was the beginning of the South's knowledge of him and hatred of him. It was the beginning of a career devoted essentially to emancipating the slaves, but again, doing it on a timetable that politically made sense.
Well, the book is very fascinating. You tell the story of these three women and their families, and take us into this really tumultuous age that is interesting to read about here in 2020 and 2021, where you see another tumultuous age where it feels like, you know, the wheels are coming off society, and yet things keep turning. And it's really, I found it a really interesting book. You write at the end, you know, I'm a journalist, not a historian. But for my reading, The Agitators is a first-rate history. So in your view, what does that journalistic background bring to this particular story?
I think that's a good question. I haven't been asked it. I think it must be basic curiosity and then an obsession with getting to the heart of a story. And I'm an editor at The New Yorker, and that's my day job. And so I spend a lot of my time working with long, complicated, very deeply reported narratives. And so I've sort of learned through my editing experience how you put together a good story, and also what is required to assemble all of the facts in order to create a story that makes sense and that is true, you know, that is deeply true and reveals something that hasn't been revealed otherwise. You know, that kept me going on this. And I did keep uncovering, you know, new amazing things that to me spoke volumes about the antebellum era and then the Civil War years. And as you say, that also continue to reverberate in quite disturbing ways in what we're living through today. This period was really the beginnings of modern politics in America. And we have to remember how young the country was at the time. I mean, there were people who remembered George Washington. It was you know, only a generation or so removed from the first American Revolution.
Well, it's a really interesting story. The Agitators. Dorothy, thanks you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dorothy Wickenden is the executive editor of The New Yorker magazine and hosts their weekly podcast, Politics and More. Her new book is titled The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.